Our first case for argument, Arrow Gear versus Downers Grove Sanitary Appeal and others. Downers Grove Sanitary. Mr. Rosemarin, are you first?
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Carius Rosemarin for Appellant Arrow Gear Company. Four components comprise Arrow Gear's position in this case. First, claim splitting is an exception to res judicata, as explicitly stated in the restatement of judgment second, section 26A, 1A and B. Second, the Seventh Circuit has recognized section 26 for at least the past 20 years. Third, all parties in this case intended to and did split their claims in accordance with the restatement by signing the Munis settlement agreements. We ask the Court to honor that intent. And fourth, each appellee waived any right it had to assert res judicata the moment it signed the Munis settlement agreements. Remarkably, appellees dispute only one of these four components. They maintain that despite the clear language of the settlement agreements, they make the bald assertion that they did not intend to split their claims.
Well, the settlement agreement clear. The problem with it is that you've got, so this is the paragraph, looking at one of them, I think they're all pretty much the same. It says settlement agreement, limited release, and paragraph 3 says limited release. And that paragraph is very broad. And then you go to the next page, the second paragraph, and then you have a very broad exception. Like, these releases do not release any claims other than specified claims. That's narrow, and it specifies, sort of, a bunch of claims. Well, it says, but how do we put these together? I mean, look how broad the first paragraph of 3 is.
Your Honor, I acknowledge it's broad, but I also call the Court's attention to the fact that the second paragraph, which appellees simply do not acknowledge, specifically reserves the claim that Arrow Gear has brought.
What is it, to make sense of this document, what would be an example of what was released?
What was released was the $15.75 million at issue in the Munis claims. Those did not, that pot of money did not include, for example, the hookup costs, which are at issue in this case.
So is that all that this paragraph releases, the Munis money, the Munis getting contribution from the defendants in this case with regard to the $15.7 million?
That's all, Your Honor. Okay. It was purely a contribution case. And that is exactly what was intended. Indeed, as I just said, there were, in fact, two pots of money there in 2006 and 2007 when the Munis defendants were figuring out how to allocate their collective liability. They had pending all the EPA costs, which had not yet been allocated. Therefore, in order to resolve the Munis case, they simply split their claims. Seventh Circuit has adopted Section 26 in Torres again in 1987.
Mr. Rosemarin, before you go any further with the merits, if you would address the threshold question of jurisdiction that sort of got sidetracked in this case. There was initially some jurisdictional briefing when the case came to us, and that was never resolved.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, we maintain that this court has complete appellate jurisdiction over the case that we have brought.
What about the cases that say that if the plaintiff dismisses without prejudice some of his claims, which means he could refile them and not face a res judicata defense, that's manufacturing finality? There are cases that say that. So what do you do with that?
There are cases that say that, Your Honor. However, in this case, it is clear that when we dismissed HW Holding and Corning, we did it under Rule 41, which was purely as of right. The cases
that... That makes no difference. I don't see how that could make the slightest bit of difference. The point is, if you dismiss without prejudice, you can refile, right? And then we would decide the case. We'd decide this case, and then you'd refile and have another case, and we have another appeal. So we would have divided appeals in cases arising from the same facts without a Rule 54B certification by the district judge.
Your Honor, I acknowledge there's some tension there, except...
There's more than tension. In fact, what you should do, you should tell us that your dismissal is with prejudice, that you're not going to refile the case.
Your Honor...
And if you are going to refile it, we're not going to have appellate jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I'm authorized to advise the court that, in fact, we will not refile the case.
That's fine.
Return to the issue of the courts of Section 26. The court has, in fact, acknowledged Section 26, and, in fact, we acknowledge that this court cannot uphold the district court without betraying its adherence to Section 26 or violating the Supreme Court's case in Kekkonen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosemarin. Mr. Ezron? Are you representing Precision?
I am, Your Honor. My name is Mark Erzin. I do represent...
Is there any difference between your case and Arrowgear's?
Yes, in its procedural posture. My case was decided on the pleadings. Mr. Rosemarin's case, Arrowgear's case, was decided on summary judgment. If my case was allowed to proceed, I expect we would wind up in substantially the same place, but we were not allowed to proceed that far. And so I have a issue, which is a dismissal on the pleadings, which we feel was incorrect. We felt our complaint did, in fact, state a valid cause of action and should not have been dismissed under the res judicata grounds.
Do you have the appellate jurisdiction issue that Judge Sykes said?
No, not. We actually... continued our case against HW Holdings and Corning, and they are, in fact, here today as appellees in our case. So slightly different parties. The settlement agreements, which my case never got to, are still the same. So Mr. Rosemarin's case, Earl Gear's case, is further down the road than my case. My case was killed in its infancy. I only wanted to address two points, which I think are the nub of the Precision Brand Products appeal, and they are whether we have the right under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 13G to defer filing the claims which we have now brought as part of this case. And Rule 13G provides for a form of claim splitting in that it says that as between co-parties, you are allowed to, but not required to, file cross-claims, even if those cross-claims arise from the same transaction or occurrence. We did not file the claims that are present in this case, in Muniz's case. We deferred them. As Mr. Rosemarin said, that was part of a much larger matrix of issues that the parties had and were dealing with in various forums in different ways.
Well, Mr. Rosemarin, maybe I should have asked him, but I'll ask you. Mr. Rosemarin said that what was released were cross-claims fighting over who would have to bear the brunt of the $15.7 million in the Muniz case. But now there's a new pot. So how big is this new pot?
The total pot, well...
Including the $15.7?
No, sir. The $15.75 million that was paid to the Muniz class is dead, buried, put away, and 8 feet under.
Right.
We're not concerned about that. That's been...
Right.
financed and taken care of amongst the parties. The new pot we're talking about now is about $4.788 million in hookup costs that a group of companies paid to hook different households to public water to avoid the contamination issue. another million that we have paid to the U.S. EPA to conduct a remedial investigation. Again, these are monies that my client and other companies have paid directly, not have anything to do with the Muniz case. And additionally, Your Honor, because the EPA has moved with, I don't want to say characteristic slowness, but it has not moved with alacrity, we are still pending.
Characteristic slowness will cover it, yeah.
We are still waiting for further decisions that may, in fact, increase those numbers. There's still an operable Unit 2, which will address may address some things. There are issues as to what we have to do within the industrial park to address our individual contamination issues. That is covered in this case by a declaratory judgment request, which we have included, which would cover future costs and allocate those amongst the parties. So, yeah, it's a much different claim, and no, it has nothing to do with the 15.75. Currently, it's in the a little bit less than probably $6 million that we're attempting to allocate amongst responsible
You're
parties.
Saying it. I see. Right now, it's almost six, but it could grow. Yeah.
It could grow, and for example, the EPA has six-some million dollars that it claims it has incurred that has not presented a bill for us yet. So where this will go, I don't know, but we feel it's important enough to make sure that we do, in fact, lay the groundwork for allocating those costs amongst all the responsible parties at this point. You know, back to my point is, you know, 13, cut to the nub, 13G says that you can defer filing cross-claims between co-parties. We did so with respect to these particular claims. We did, however, in Muniz, file contribution cross-claims, purely contribution. The question then began, or became, which the district court addressed, as to whether filing a contribution cross-claim transferred or transmuted the parties from co-parties into opposing parties and implicated 13A's mandatory or compulsory cross-claim requirements. Every court that's looked at this, Rainbow Management, there's a whole series of them, Paramount.
There's not a lot of circuit case law on this.
There is not a lot, Your Honor, yes. But the cases that there's unanimity in every case that has looked at it, including a couple, you know, state Supreme Court cases, which the underlying rules that they applied were equivalent to the federal rules. So I think that that is, sure, at least an appellate level where they dealt with the policy issues, which was my last point, which is that the policy issues involved here are important. In a complex environmental case, I don't think that the district court or this court wants to see intramural disputes among the potentially responsible parties of who's to pay the EPA costs, who's to pay for hooking things up, who's to pay for cleaning up, be laid like a blanket on top of a Muniz case where those parties are trying to recover from us damages that they allegedly suffered. The two cases are not compatible, would add a level of complexity that would probably mean that the district court would be dealing with the Muniz case or pieces of it at this very day. So we think that both the language of 13G and the policy articulated by the courts who have addressed this issue, this precise issue, both require that the district court's decision be reversed because it is simply not the correct not the correct law and not the law that this circuit wants to apply.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. O'Connell?
Good morning. My name is Laura O'Connell, and I'm arguing for the appellees today. I represent Lovejoy. But all of the appellees have a common argument in the Precision case. Three of the appellees have a common argument in the Aerogear case. Corning and HW Holding are not parties to the Aerogear appeal.
I'm sorry. You'll have to speak a little louder.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Let me get closer to the microphone. So I just wanted the court to understand that point. But neither Rule 13G or Section 26 of the Restatement of Judgments governs these cases. These cases are governed by the federal rule of res judicata, and that rule says when you bring a claim in...
That's not right. I mean, look, res judicata is a defense, can be waived, okay. It can be cut down, you know, carved down by an agreement. No problem about that.
That's right, Your Honor. But there was no waiver here. They argue there was a waiver because we signed settlement agreements, but those settlement agreements this court held, the Supreme Court held in Kekkonen that when you just...
You have a complete misunderstanding of Kekkonen, as does the district judge. What Kekkonen is about is if you have a settlement of a federal case, it doesn't follow that you can bring a lawsuit to enforce that settlement, because the jurisdiction you had to bring the federal case doesn't continue into a dispute over the settlement agreement. You have to find another jurisdictional basis. That has no application to this case, because they're not suing to enforce the settlement agreement. They're suing under CERCLA, and the jurisdiction is conferred by 1331. So they bring their federal suit. You defend with res judicata, and they say, well, no, that's no good because we have these settlements. They're not trying to predicate federal jurisdiction on the settlements. They're just using it as a defense to your res judicata defense.
Your Honor, I agree with you. These cases are different than Kekkonen and cases like Lynch, because in Lynch and Kekkonen,
they have no application to this case, because their case is about federal jurisdiction to enforce a settlement of a federal case, and they say there isn't federal jurisdiction. But these people, Arrow Gear and Precision, they're not trying to enforce, they're not bringing a suit to enforce the settlement. They're using the settlement as a defense to your defense of res judicata. There's no obstacle to that in any case. You always do that.
Well, the district court had federal question jurisdiction. It had pendant jurisdiction over their CERCLA claims that they asserted, Judge. I agree with you.
Right.
They found those claims were barred by res judicata. They wanted the district court to go on and find that settlement agreements upended the dismissal with prejudice.
Exactly. And, of course, you can. Look, these parties could have said, look, if we ever have another dispute, we agree we're not going to plead res judicata. We'll start over from scratch. We like that. We like litigation. So there's nothing illegal about that.
I agree with you, Your Honor, but the district court in this case, despite Lynch's the language in Lynch, which was that if the parties went to state court, got an order that said you could come back here now and try your federal claim again, even though you dismissed it with rape.
What do you need an order from a state court? I don't understand that. A federal court can interpret any document, even if that document couldn't be the basis of a federal lawsuit.
Even if what this would do, Your Honor, is put the law of final judgments into chaos. There's a reason we put with prejudice in our orders. We don't want to see this case again. 14 parties paid $16 million to
settle
the case.
Well, then you shouldn't have signed the settlement agreement. If you really thought that you could wipe out all these, you know, cross claims at a stroke, you should have made
The settlement agreement's release.
What's the purpose of the settlement agreement? What's the purpose of this paragraph, which very explicitly says these releases do not release any claims? What's the significance of that?
Other than munis, Your Honor, there's the language. There's a number of settlements here.
What is the force of
other
this paragraph?
Munis.
What does this do? What's its legal operative force? These releases do not release any claims other than the specified claims.
There were ongoing personal injury cases at the time. Those cases were settled.
Okay, so now we're just talking about the scope of this settlement agreement. We're beyond Kekkonen and Lynch and all that stuff. We're just talking about what actually did they reserve. That's the only issue. What did you reserve?
There are four settlements, Your Honor.
Pardon?
There are four settlement agreements. And the first settlement agreement was among all the defendants in the Muniz case. And they settled and they agreed to submit their claims to binding arbitration. It is Arrow Gear Document 98, Exhibit A to Attachment 1. And they said the claims would be defined as all matters which were asserted in Muniz or which could have been asserted in Muniz.
I want you to look at the settlement agreement and tell me what you think was not released.
The exclusionary language
was released.
Says, Your Honor, in any administrative proceeding, which
No. I'm looking. The key paragraph is, this is page 5 of the 26-page settlement agreement.
Is it with one of the third parties, Your Honor, or is it the one that followed the mediation?
Well, I'm not sure, but you can pick any of the settlement agreements, and we'll just. I want to talk. They're all pretty similar. I want you to talk about the paragraph in each of these settlements, which reserves a lot of claims. You know, says they're not part of. They're not being released, right?
Well, in the settlement with Lovejoy, the exclusionary language says that it does not release claims in any litigation or administrative proceeding other than munis, including Pote Bendix, State of Illinois, and Lovejoy versus Corning case, or claims relating to the contamination at EIP, except to the extent they were addressed in munis. They brought cross claims and third party claims in munis. They came into district court and asked Judge Dara to dismiss those claims with prejudice. 14 parties paid $16 million. 14 of them agreed to go to binding arbitration. It has an arbitrability clause in that agreement. Any disputes as to what this arbitration agreement covers needs to be arbitrated.
Let me point you to one of the paragraphs. This is on page 17 of Arrowgear's brief. No, of Precision's brief. But it doesn't matter. And it says, as to DGSD, these releases do not release any claims other than specified claims and do not release claims that may arise in other litigation or in other contexts related to alleged contamination at the Ellsworth Industrial Park. And then it lists a bunch of claims. And it says, in administrative proceedings arising from the alleged contamination at and near to the Ellsworth Industrial Park. Well, aren't there administrative proceedings, you know, the EPA and so on, continuing? And aren't those reserved by this paragraph?
No, Your Honor.
What is the force of the paragraph?
Your Honor, I'm not certain what they meant, because the release language in all the settlement agreements
is
broad.
Don't we need a trial? If these are ambiguous contracts, we need a trial to disambiguate them?
Your Honor, not when claims are dismissed with prejudice. They brought an entire claim.
Look. Res judicata is waivable. And the question is the scope of this waiver. And if it's ambiguous, then we need a trial.
Judge, we never waived the defense of res judicata.
That's what these settlements do.
The carve-out language is a res judicata waiver.
The carve-out language didn't carve out the munis claim.
That's the issue. And at best, it seems to me, this is ambiguous as to what it carves out.
Well, and the Lovejoy and Corning agreements are very explicit that the specific costs at issue in this litigation are carved out. The narrowing language in the DGSD and Belmont agreements is broad enough to encompass the costs that are sought here in contribution, but the language in the Corning agreement is much more precise, and the language in the Lovejoy agreement even more so, because it explicitly lists claims relating to the cost of providing public water to homes in the munis class area, cost of any investigation in the Ellsworth Industrial Park, and response costs or damage claims of any government or governmental agency. So there's explicit language in the carve-out provision in the Lovejoy agreement that covers this litigation. That's inescapable.
Right, Your Honor. And then there's some additional language, except to the extent they were addressed in munis. And
which they
the
aren't.
Underlying settlement agreement was a settlement and agreement to arbitrate. No one ever intended to come back to court to
says except try. To the limited extent that those costs were addressed in the munis settlement payment. But this is explicit about the hookup, where, according to your opponent, they have had to spend almost $5 million on this hookup. And that's what they want.
Your Honor, the whole reason for the Muniz case was the hookup costs. If the dismissal with prejudice...
But look, this is reserving the hookup costs, right? Providing public water to homes in the Muniz class area. That's the hookup, right? That's in the release.
And that's in a release...
I mean, that's in the reservation to the release, right?
Your Honor, I'm not certain what settlement agreement you're looking at. Not certain what settlement agreement you're looking at. If it's the 2000.
This is Lovejoy. I'm following up on what Judge Seitz
said. In 2007.
I don't remember the time.
Says it's a settlement agreement attached to the First Amended complaint.
Yes, and that's the settlement agreement that grew from the mediation that the parties had in lieu of arbitration. The mediation that the parties held in lieu of arbitration.
The of your statement.
There.
Are you saying this is irrelevant, the Lovejoy?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a year after this case, the claims were dismissed with prejudice, and it was not at the time of the Muniz case.
What does it matter whether it's before or after?
I think it does, Your Honor. What happened was we settled with the plaintiff class. We agreed to pay them almost $16 million. We entered dismissals with prejudice and agreement to arbitrate all those claims. The parties then went and actually mediated instead of arbitrated. They agreed to do that. They decided they wanted to try to avoid the cost of arbitration. That was April 2007, I think, is the agreement you're looking at. The claims in Muniz were dismissed with prejudice in October and June of 2006.
But they're saying explicitly that the agreement does not resolve and shall not be construed to settle, release, or discharge these hookup claims. Why would they enter into such an agreement if they thought that the hookup claims had been extinguished by the judgments? What would the sense of it be?
I don't know what was in their minds, Your Honor. Well, but I do know that we were relying on our dismissal with prejudice.
Don't we need a trial to figure out what it means?
Your Honor, what they're proposing would put the law of final judgments into chaos. Let me
suggest to you, if I'm looking at A37 in the brief of Arrow Gear, and it says, the settlement agreement is entered into by the undersigned effective April 1, 2007, whereas effective June 13, 2006, the following parties, listing them, entered into a settlement agreement. Is that's not right?
That was the settlement agreement to arbitrate, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct.
And then it has the reservation that Judge Posner has been reading on page 12 of that particular settlement agreement. A39 supplemental appendix.
Right, and it does have language in there that it says except as to the extent those claims were addressed in Muniz. We think that when you bring a claim, the law is you have to bring the entire claim. There was no way they could split the claims that they brought against
us. You're saying they were premature. They had to wait until they spent this extra $5 million on hookup costs.
No, Your Honor.
How should they have proceeded?
I think they should have proceeded as the parties agreed, go to binding mediation or mediation in lieu of arbitration, which is what we did. There's no dispute here.
They should have proceeded. All these agreements are with you.
Yes, Your Honor.
You say they threw them into chaos. Well, you threw them in. If this caused chaos with final judgments, you're as culpable as they are.
Well, 14 parties wouldn't have paid $16 million if they thought they were going to come back and
retry. You have to speak up.
14 parties would not have paid $16 million if they thought they were going to come back and try these cases again.
Well, then you signed a foolish agreement, if that's what you think.
Put the language in the order that the claims were dismissed with prejudice.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Anything further from the appellants? Okay. Thank you very much to all counsel. We'll move on to